last week of choose the God of your choice. And that's based on how Athens was a city so full of idolatry, people had a choice. And they did have an altar there to the unknown God, so that would be a choice as well. Paul revealed that the unknown God, the one that they didn't know, was the true God of heaven. Now, following up on that, we've got this sermon here for tonight, which is empty temples. Now, if you remember, and those that were here, spent some time pointing out that the reason that there's no action or anything like that, or answers from gods that are represented by idols and other things of that nature, is because, well, there's no God there. So it stands to reason then that empty temples follows along after that. But Athens was a city that was engulfed with idols, and Paul encountered this altar there, a place for worship, of course, that was devoted to the unknown God, and he sets about to reveal him, as we mentioned earlier. But one of the things that he determines to do while he's got this opportunity is to declare that God does not dwell in temples made with hands. Look at verse 24 with me. The God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. I'm sure many of us have read that, heard that on a number of occasions. And we have a tendency sometimes to point this out to others, but we ought to realize it has application for us as well. But the setting in which this is delivered, you almost have to appreciate the boldness of the apostle in doing this. His words would indeed seem provocative to the Athenians. In other words, it would provoke them to want to hear more and to think about these things and so on, because this was different than what they were used to. So Paul is speaking here on the Areopagus, or Mars Hill, in Athens. And if he looked above him, he would see the temples on the Acropolis. And up on the Acropolis is probably the one that we know the best. Up on the Acropolis, that was the top of the hill. And up there was the temple of that was known as the Parthenon. Now, while that's a well-known feature of Greek ancient times, what a lot of folks don't understand or realize is that the Parthenon, while it was the largest temple in Athens, it was a temple of Athena, whom Athens was named after. So if he looked above him, he could see that. Be right up there visible from what was called Mars Hill. If he looked below him, he would see the Agora, or the marketplace. And as we pointed out last week, every place, it didn't matter if you went, if there was a place over here that made shoelaces, a little shop, inside that shop was some kind of an idol, and so the shop itself became a temple to whatever god that was. All of them were that way. If, for example, to take a modern day thing, if there was a place where you went to pay your water bill, it was also a temple, and so on and so on and so on it went. So they had temples aplenty. And Paul here now is declaring to all of them, your temples are empty. Now, that had to be a real eye-opener. And if you were there, you were an Athenian, and you were used to this kind of thing, surely that had to get your attention and probably hold their attention for the duration of what he had to say. But then, now here's the other thing. What of the unknown God? What of him? Well, he's the creator of everything. He's the Lord of heaven and earth. He's the great God Almighty. And he doesn't dwell in an earthly temple. That's what Paul's saying. Not only would this be startling information for the Athenians to digest, I think sometimes it's equally so to many today who might call themselves Christians, whether they're in the church or not. So let's just think about this for a few moments, and let's just think about the general subject of temples. Well, yeah, there are temples. The Gentiles had many temples. They had some were more famous than others. I think probably the one that's the most famous in the New Testament is the Temple of Diana at Ephesus. Or some translations might have the Temple of Artemis. One's the Roman name, the other is the Greek name. Then, of course, as we mentioned just a moment ago, there's the Parthenon. That was the Temple of Athena in Athens. Now, Paul, later on, after this, leaves Athens and winds up down in the area of Corinth. And Corinth's on that little neck of land that separates the Greek peninsula. And Corinth was on the west side and Cenchreae's on the east side. They're kind of sister cities. But when he gets to Corinth, there are temples there, a couple of them, that are well known, and artifacts and other things, archaeological discoveries, temples to Apollos and Aphrodite, however you want to pronounce it, there in Corinth. So you've got all of these things, and at one time or another, Paul was either, Paul was in the proximity of all of them, as well as I'm sure many others. But they all had something in common, and what was in common? They were all empty. Every one of them. Now, as we would point out, last week, there are no gods there. So their gods don't dwell in those temples because there's no God. There is no Diana. There is no Apollos, etc., etc. So they don't dwell there. But then what about other temples? Well, the greatest temple, if we think about it, now the greatest temple of New Testament times, and I think there's very little question about this, was the one that was in Jerusalem. It really... Now, I know there were different stages of the temple, but it was really the only one the Jews ever had. Now, they had, I understand, synagogues and other things like that that were substitutions that came about on the basis of situation. Synagogues started when they were carried off into captivity. They couldn't go to Jerusalem to carry out their feasts and other things and to meet and so on, so they met. This is the best thing they could do, and synagogues came up. And a synagogue came from a word which simply just meant a meeting place. And they even had synagogues in Israel after they returned there. But as far as the temple goes, that's the only one they ever had. The original was built by Solomon. The date here could be off 3 or 4 years, but anyway, 957 B.C., now, one source says that it took 183,600 men 7.5 years to build. I'm sure there was some transition in those numbers and different ones in 7.5 years. But now, when it was completed, it was the most costly structure ever built up to that time. And it was also... At the time that it was built now, it was the largest structure in the world. A lot of times we see these listing of things, the seven wonders of the world, man-made wonders, natural wonders, other things like this. And at this particular time when the temple was, it was the wonder of the world. Apparently it could be seen from a long distance. And it just stood out because, you know, the rest of the city, the buildings were small, they were dwelling places, other things like that. And the temple and the walls and everything, in New Testament times, it was just absolutely magnificent. And the Jews had a certain amount of, they were proud of the building and where they worshiped God. And decidedly so. It was still one of the largest buildings in the world. All the things that focused and centered on it, that related to them, And even other people, not Jews, that would be there would leave remarks for posterity down to these very days of the magnificence of this temple in Jerusalem. It was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar in 586 B.C. Now, it was destroyed deliberately. It was rebuilt by, well, through the agency of Zerubbabel in 516 B.C. It was remodeled and expanded by Herod the Great. And, I mean, it was really remodeled. It was expanded in a really, really big way. It was already big. But Herod, when he did anything, he did it on a very grand scale. And so he did this. That was about 20 B.C. And the temple that was there at the end and some of the things that you see now, the foundation stones are, some of those are just enormous. Some of those stones in there, one of them is just unbelievable how big it is. But most of them were so large when they were brought in there, they didn't have to mortar them or fasten them together or anything like that. They all fit together and have stayed together through all these centuries and based on their own weight. I mean, you're talking of one of those stones in there being over, well, it's in hundreds of tons. So it was really something. Very little exists. The Wailing Wall exists. A few gates and other things like that. But and as large as they are, and then you think about the rest of it on the scale of what's there now, helps to project it out to how truly enormous it was. And yet, while all of this was done, all of this time, all of this involvement, and everything else. And the magnificence of it that's been recorded. There's something interesting that you find in the book of 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles chapter 2 is another. There's one in 1 Kings. But it's another description of the building of the temple by Solomon. 2 Chronicles chapter 2. Verses 5 and 6. The house which I am about to build will be great, for greater is our God than all the gods. Well, that's right. But now notice now, but who is able to build a house for him? For the heavens and the highest, for the heavens and the highest heavens cannot contain him. So who am I that I should build a house for him except to burn incense before him? You see what Solomon's saying here? He's saying, we're building this temple. But now we don't need to think that God dwells in this temple, that we've somehow or another got him boxed in. That it's actually a place for us where we can go and worship him collectively. We're going to go there and burn incense. That's what he means by that. But now don't get into your head for a moment that's where God dwells, and boy, we've got him boxed in, fenced in, however you want to put that. Now I understand when the temple was completed that the glory of the Lord and the cloud and all that and everything involved, whatever it was with the glory of the Lord, not the cloud, but all that, the cloud went in the tabernacle, but all the glory of the Lord came into the temple. But, God wasn't, that didn't mean that God was in there and he remained in there like he was trapped or something. And, and Solomon understood that. So, when you think about this, that, well, God didn't dwell in that temple as magnificent as it was and what was built for and everything else. And even though some might call it the dwelling place of God, he really didn't dwell there. His presence might be there, but he doesn't really dwell. And so, that brings us back to these words that Paul said in Acts chapter 17, verse 24. That applies to the temple in Jerusalem also. Don't think that God dwells in temples made with hands. Because, he doesn't. And he didn't even back there You know, even in the Old Testament, Paul's saying, you know, it doesn't happen today either. But now what we have to do sometimes is deal with this modern concept of temples and things of that nature. One of the modern concept, I guess, basically, we would talk about the largest one that just covers so much ground, is that church buildings are temples. Well, they're not. I know that there had been, you know, we used to go to Jonesboro, Arkansas. That was the next biggest city closest to us there in Arkansas. We lived in Tuckerman. And one of the main drags going in, I believe it was the one that went past the fairgrounds and ended up down where they had built a new mall and things like that. And there were nicer restaurants in there after the mall got in there. That's kind of where we would go down in there. But when you went down that main drag, I can't remember what the name of the street was. But you went by, and if you noticed over here on the south side of the road, you would go past what the Baptist Temple. What was the Baptist Church? But they called it a temple. Do you suppose they thought that the church building was the temple? Well, the chances are real good that they did. And I can remember one of the largest Baptist churches in Indianapolis one time was the Indianapolis Baptist Temple. So sometimes people, that's what they think. And then branching off of that comes the idea and the belief, well, that's believed to be the dwelling place of God. And yet Paul's words would hold here also. He doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. Well, it doesn't matter who you are. Baptist, Lutheran, whatever. Even Christians. Even us. He doesn't dwell in a building made with hands. And what about us? I admit that sometimes brethren get overblown on the building. And I think sometimes this idea comes along in different measures. But now let me also point another thing out here. I remember listening to a couple of fellows debating the point about what went on in the building. And what they were talking about was this business of food, fun, and frolic in the building. And the people that were in favor of that kind of thing spent most of their time pointing out how the building's just nothing. And it's not holy ground, it's not sacred, and all that was true. I wasn't in on the argument, I was listening to it. And the other side of the story is those who were opposing the food, fun, and frolic agreed with that point. Now, I might have, if I'd been there, agreed with that point, but then I would also have said, but you want to consider this as well. That building was built, wherever your building's at, it was built with funds that were collected on Sunday as a contribution for, now get ready, the Lord's work. So it's not just some pile of junk. It's got some meaning. But let's just not take that off too far to the point that we think, well, it's like a temple or something like that. It is something that's important, but not all the way. As some might go. It's a means to an end. Now, God doesn't dwell in this building either. Now I understand, I want to hasten to point out, I understand that God's presence might here be with us. We're gathered together to worship Him, and we're told that when we do that, His presence is with us. That's right. But you know, if we're not here, the presence isn't here. The presence is centered on the fact that there are those of His people, His children, who gather together. That's when it happens. And that would be the case if, I don't know if something would happen and we would have to meet someplace else, wherever that's at, it would be the same thing over there as well. Because God doesn't dwell in a temple. He doesn't dwell in a building that's made with hands. Now, what the New Testament teaches on this is that God does have a temple. Now, Not like I'm talking about here, not a temple that's made with hands. That's right. What Paul said applies Old Testament, New Testament. But really, not like that. He has a temple that's more glorious than any other that ever came before it. Oh, even the temple in Jerusalem? Yeah, even the temple in Jerusalem. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 5. You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house. How about that? A spiritual house. Not physical, but spiritual. Living stones, like stones that make up a temple or a building or something like that. Yeah. But you're living stones, and each one of you are part of the spiritual house. Now, one of the things that we see in the follow-up on this idea of a spiritual dwelling place, that's the point. In Ephesians chapter 2, starting in verse 19, Ephesians chapter 2, verse 19. Let me get it up there. There we go. So then you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and are of God's household. Having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the cornerstone. If you can't see the fact that it's talking about spiritual things in verse 20, I don't know what it would take to get you to see that. We're not talking about something that's built on the physical apostles and the prophets. And that Jesus Christ himself is the physical corner. It's all the idea of presenting this. The idea, the concept. But then it goes on to say in verse 21, in whom the whole building. They're not all the building. But the whole building being fitted together. Now watch now. Is growing into a holy temple in the Lord. A spiritual temple. A holy temple. Not physical. In whom, now here we go, in whom you also are being built together here into a dwelling of God in the Spirit. God doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. But then he says, he's dwelling in you. And you and I are part of this spiritual house. Well, it's not made with hands. We're not made with hands. But God dwells in us. And that's something that's taught many times in the Scriptures. And I think sometimes, well, we don't get that idea. But the Christians were told, 1 Corinthians chapter 3, 16, 17, I'm sure we're familiar with that, where he says, you are the temple of God. This is those who he's writing to. He's not writing to a building somewhere. Chances are they didn't have one. But he's writing to the church at Corinth and telling them, you're the temple of God. So it's a spiritual temple is what it is. And it's for a spiritual being, a spiritual dwelling for a spiritual being. God dwells in us, spiritually speaking. And also, this all goes back to what he had to say, that it's not made with hands. Now, if we think about that being the dwelling place of God today, back up here, we find the idea of the dwelling place of God. Now, back in the Old Testament, it was said to be holy. But really, wherever God's presence was at, that was said to be holy, wasn't it? Do you remember? Whenever Moses turned aside to see the bush that was on fire but was not consumed by the fire, and when he got there, the voice told him to take off his shoes. You're in holy ground. Why was it holy ground? Well, it's because the presence of God was there. All right, so the presence of God might make the temple holy when God's presence was there. What about New Testament times? Well, the temple of God, the church, individuals, were part of it. And that's supposed to be holy as well. A counterpart to the word holy, as it's used in this sense, might be found back in the Old Testament. I always think of it this way. When you read about things being holy in the New Testament, and by the way, the word holy comes from the same word that the word saints come from, and the word sanctify comes from, all comes from the same word. So if you say, you know, holy and saints and sanctified, you're all talking about this. They're all related here in this way. Okay, that's fine. But what does it all mean? Well, back in the Old Testament, we're probably familiar with the idea that there were things that were dedicated or consecrated to God. Like all the things that were built for the temple. Well, now they weren't supposed to be. You know, they would have something like an ash pan, you know, that there at the altar, you shoved that in and got the ashes out from the fire that was built. And even from the animal that was parts of the animal that were burnt. But you got the ashes out. You know, you build a fire with something. And so there's going to be ashes from all that. And plus from what you burn up that aren't to produce fire. But you had the ash pans and you had other things. You had hooks. And, you know, for meat and other things like this, they had all kinds of things there. And even those things, as mundane as those things might be, they weren't supposed to be used for something else. You just didn't, I can't find the ash pan around here, honey. I'm going to go over to the temple and get one so we can kind of clean out the fireplace over here. You didn't do that. The reason you didn't do that was the ash pan was said to be dedicated or consecrated to the Lord. Wasn't supposed to be used for common things. There was a determination, a separation made. It was dedicated. It was consecrated. And to me, I think that the idea of, well, there's holy and there's sanctification and then there's those saints, well, yeah, they're kind of set apart, dedicated, consecrated in the same way. And I really think that really changes the landscape sometimes. If you just think about someone who's a Christian, someone who's a saint, and Jesus Himself said, "Be ye holy as He is holy." And I've listened to people, "Oh, well, we can't be holy, blah, blah, blah." Why? What's the problem? Don't say, "We can't be holy." I think the real thing to say is sometimes we don't want to be. We're not going to even try to be. But we are supposed to be holy. And dedicated and consecrated to God? Yeah. Absolutely. In Romans chapter 12 and in verse 1. It says, "Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship." There's that word there. Well, we'll use that word a lot. You know, I know preachers, and I'm one of them now, and we like that passage there, verse 1 and 2. They really do. Well, that's me and you that are in there, and we're supposed to present our bodies a living and holy sacrifice. Dedicated, consecrated, sacrifice to the Lord. 2 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 1. "Therefore, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all defilements, defilement of flesh and spirit." Now watch. "Perfecting holiness in the fear of God." Well, there it is, used there again, and that's about Christians. Now, what was that? We might as well just give it up. We can't be holy. It seems as though we're expected to be. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 5. I'm sorry. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 15. But like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves also in all your behavior. Okay? I think, you know, it's like we rest the case about those who are Christians are supposed to be holy, consecrated, dedicated to the Lord. And as His dwelling place, yeah, that's what's expected of us. And so, you know, we really shouldn't be just turning ourselves over and our service over to common things. I like to think this is one of the reasons why when we come together to worship God, we're sticklers about it. And I think we ought to be sticklers about it. Now, people can say whatever they want to about that. I don't care. I'm more interested in what God says and what He expects of us. Now, you've already seen everything that we've looked at. And to me, this idea that some people get in their heads, that, well, when we meet together, I'm going to use their words now. When we meet together, we don't want to appear to be too churchy. Because there might be some people come in and they'll be turned off because we're too churchy. What's that mean? I can tell you what it means. It means what you're doing, that you need to kind of dumb it down. How's that sound? And there's a lot of places, they're doing that kind of thing. Oh, we don't want it to be too churchy. So let's make it kind of loose. And let's kind of make it, we'll just kind of just go with the flow. And we'll make it user-friendly. Well, it'll be God-friendly, not user-friendly. But I think because of this and the idea of being consecrated and dedicated to the Lord, and if that comes off to some people as churchy, so what? I think that's what we ought to be. I think we ought to be sticklers about it. I think we ought to insist on a certain amount of decorum and other things and not have to apologize for it or think we've got to dumb it down for other folks. The modern thing today is for everything to become casual. That's the big thing, casual. Now, I'm not calling for a dress code or anything like that. But this idea of everything being casual, you know. I mean, when somebody is called on to lead a prayer and they walk up to the front and they've got on sandals, shorts, and a T-shirt with five or six holes tore in it, we've pretty well dumbed it down. And where's the decorum? Where's this separation? Where's this being sticklers for things? And, oh, it just doesn't matter. Let's just do this and that and the other. And so on. And whatever somebody wants, if somebody wants to do something, well, just speak out, brother, and we'll just let you go with it. Does that sound like it was done that way in the Old Testament or the New Testament? Does that sound like it's some of the things we've looked at, dedicated, consecrated to God? No, it really doesn't. And again, if this doesn't fly with some folks, I don't see, and I am not going to do it, and I've never done it. I don't think there's any need or urge. There's no urge. And there's really no need to go about apologizing about it. This is what we find in the New Testament. This is what we do. And it's important, and it matters. Now, granted, you can go to excess on this, like some people can with the building. But just because some people can go to excess on it doesn't mean, well, we ought to just, you know, get down here to where there's just nothing about it at all in the building. It just doesn't matter what it does. But, you know, some people go to too much of excess, you know, with the way they worship. So I'm sure that's happened. But I don't think that means we just throw the whole thing out the window. And just get in there and just wing it and it doesn't matter. We're caretakers, this is what we are, we're caretakers of the temple. If all this is true, that's what we are. for the caretakers. What's that temple like? That spiritual temple. That's us, you see. And here's the important thing now. Rather than make all of this and spend all this time trying to dumb everything down and get rid of the churchy business and all that and make it user-friendly, blah, 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 we're worried about it being acceptable to people that might walk in off the street. That's what they're trying to do. That's the whole point of it. Where it seems to me, is it acceptable to God? I think sometimes that's kind of forgotten. And so, I don't want to do the one and avoid that right there. And again, no apology made for insisting on that. And I'm sure that a number of us feel the same way. I hope that you do. Well, take your songbooks, turn to the songs being selected. In the Old Testament, there were directions that were given for the temple in Jerusalem. How to build it. Boy, they went into great detail. Maybe for the temple, the detail wasn't as great as it was for the tabernacle that was the predecessor to the temple. But there were still lots of directions on how this came about. Now, the New Testament gives us direction about the temple of God today. The temple of God today is built by first believing in Jesus Christ, the Son of God, repenting of sins, confessing Him before men, and being baptized. That's how the temple of God is built. And each one of us are a part of this. Each one of us is a part of this temple as living stones. And that's how this all comes about. And once we are part of this, we ought to conduct ourselves in such a way as to be an acceptable temple for God. Turn to the songs been selected. If you're subject to the gospel invitation, this is the right time, this is the right place to become a child of God or to make correction. And if we can assist you with that, we urge and exhort and plead with you to come. All together we stand and sing.